My name is Lily Reynolds Parker. I am a native Eugenian. I grew up on West 11th in an African-American community, went through my formal education here in Eugene, graduated from Henry D. Sheldon High School in 1964, but I didn't make it to the University of Oregon until 1986. And here I am today.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up on West 11th?
West 11th was an all-black community. And in Eugene at that time, there were three black communities, and there were probably maybe 20 families on my street. I grew up 10 siblings, even though we weren't all in the house at the same time. It was probably the best of times and the worst of times.
What do you mean by it was the worst of times?
We were out of the city limits, so we had no running water. We had no sewage. There was one way into the road I lived on and one way out. We were all economically deprived, and we were all living there because there was nowhere else we could live in Eugene, Oregon at that time.
For people who aren't aware, why was this neighborhood the only place that you and your family were allowed to live?
Because we were African American, or at that time, we were Negroes. This is where we could live at that time in Eugene, Oregon, off West 11th.
You mentioned it was also the best of times. What about that time made it the best of times?
Because I was with like-minded people who looked like me, who treated me as if I was really somebody. I was an intelligent human being. I was with people who loved me just because I was me. I could take off all the masks that I had to wear when I was off my street, out of my neighborhood, and just be me, just be a kid. You know, we didn't have much, but what we did have was important to us, and that was a sense of community, a sense of belonging, and a sense of dignity.
You had to leave your neighborhood to go to public school. What was that like for you?
It wasn't really so traumatic for me because all the kids in the neighborhood all went and caught the bus to go to Bailey Hill. What I find, as I reflect back, if we weren't at that bus stop when the bus came, if we were maybe 100 yards away and running to get there, the bus drove off and left us. I sit and watch now as the bus driver waits as kids come from two blocks away because they're late getting to the bus stop, and they wait on those children to get to the bus. Difference being was, this is in the 1950s, and we were Negroes, and these kids I see the bus waiting for today are little white kids. In my mind back then, I didn't think that bus driver is leaving me because I'm black. I thought, oh, the bus driver's leaving me because I didn't get to the bus stop on time.
Are there other things that you reflect upon in the same kind of light?
I do. When I was in elementary school, I will say 95% of the teachers we encountered didn't really endeavor to teach us. There wasn't a critical mass of African-American students so that they could put us separate but equal. So we were enrolled in the schools. However, even if you were the same age and in the same grade, they would create two classes so they did not have two black students in the same class. We weren't expected to learn. We weren't pushed, but we were moved forward. I love to sing, so my teacher would release me from class so I could go sing to all the other classes. I thought that was great. However, now I look back on it, I was missing opportunity to learn what the other students were learning. I had no reference point. I thought I was special.
What was it like going through K through 12 in Eugene during the civil rights movement during the 50s and 60s?
When the civil rights movement began in the Deep South, fortunately, we had a little television, so we were able to see the attack dogs, the cattle prods, the batons, the fire hoses. And it was hard to wrap your mind around human beings being treated this way by other human beings. But what it also did was allowed us to see though we weren't experiencing that degree of violence, we were experiencing psychological violence. Because then you could actually see the difference in how we were treated and received as students of color as compared to the other students in our classroom. So, and I'm not saying all teachers were like that, because I had some good teachers who recognized in me some gifts. But for every teacher who recognized that I had academic savvy, there were two who said, but not like us. And I don't want to give the impression that things have not improved. But you still have teachers who will put more energy into some students, not because of their inability to learn, but because of their circumstances.
So you were a member of one of the first graduating classes of Sheldon High School. Mm-hmm. During your time there, you did a lot of social justice work. What did you do?
I graduated in 64. So it was at a time when the civil rights movement was really becoming a national movement. And we decided at Sheldon that things needed to change. And we organized a chapter of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was a Stokely Carmichael-founded organization. And it was an offshoot of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And it was for students. And there was probably 8 or 9 of us who decided that we wanted to become active and to create an environment where we could cause some change to be made. How effective were we? I don't know, but people began to pay attention.
What kind of stuff did you do?
We marched. We marched for housing. We marched for jobs. I tested, applied for a job, and of course, the job was filled. We'd go with a member of the community and try to rent a house, but it was already rented. Or try to buy a house, and the loan was not available to you because you didn't make enough money. And then we would come back and report in on the results of our activism. And then there were people who went to the powers that be to say, look, this is going on. And this needs to change. And talking to people, meeting people where they were. I have to say, during that time, a lot of the population of Eugene, Oregon, didn't see themselves as being racist because it was their way of life. You know, this is how we're raised here. This is how we live. We're what's normal. You're the abnormality. Today, we still find it's hard to change people's ideology. Because racism isn't just something that's on the surface everywhere. It's institutionalized. It's built into our country's DNA. And so we just tried to do what we could as young people to make people aware of the fact that we need to make some changes.
What was the reception of these marches or, you know, going to government officials with your findings?
Well, I'll tell you, there were instances where you could feel not safe because, of course, you got threats. I was very blessed because I had a mother who was also very much involved with the movement. And my eldest brother, Sam Reynolds Jr., was also very involved with the movement. And they kind of sheltered me and protected me because I would just jump out there. I was full of energy, and I just wanted to be a part. But Sam would put me back in and he'd say, you can't do that. And then sometimes he'd say, come on, sis, we're going to go and do this and I want you to come do it with me. And I felt so empowered because my brother wanted me to go do this test with him. And we tested at one point from Eugene, Oregon to San Francisco, California. We got down in the Southern Oregon and there was 2 or 3 times where we really had to run for our life. You could just feel the hatred when we would like stop to get gas. Eye-opening, but I felt like I was doing something worthwhile. Did I ever think that someone would actually take my life? I couldn't wrap my mind around that.
You've gone through different eras of American history, but through that, through school and the education system, you've dealt with ageism, racism, and sexism. How have you seen that shift?
There was a great shift after the civil rights movement, after affirmative action, when all the isms became illegal. Were they still there? Yes. But now I'll tell you, within the last 4 or 5 years, it's beginning to resurface everywhere. And if we don't stay awake and be knowledgeable to what's going on in our world today, we'll look up and we'll be starting all over again. And I'm not saying that in a political sense. I'm saying it as a member of this society who's recognizing that my environment is changing. I'm having to now once again look over my shoulder and be aware of who's in the room with me. This is 2019. This is not 1819. We should be advancing instead of sliding backwards. So have things changed? Yes, they did change. We now have to be aware that we may be turning around and going back the other way. At this age, I'm a good consultant. I'll be here for anybody, but I want to pass the baton. And there's so many young folk who are out there today who's standing up and saying, this is not the way it's going to be. We're going to write another new chapter in this book, and we're going to change the ideology of the history of our country. Change is still happening. We're going to evolve on a daily basis. We're never going to get to the end of change, and that's good, because change is good.
Speaking of these new young folks who take inspiration from you, how do you feel about your name being on the new Black Cultural Center's building?
I am just so overwhelmed. The affirmation that I get from the students that I serve that I did my job and did it well fills me with joy. I would say to my students, this is my purpose and my passion. Once you find purpose and passion, everything else falls into place. Remember I told you about the counselor who said, no, Lily, you're Negro and girl? I promised myself, if I can do anything to open doors for young people, and particularly for young people of color, I'm going to do everything I can so that they don't have to experience what I experienced. I earned my degree. I went to work for Eugene Hospital and Clinic, but I applied for a national search at the university for an advisor in the Office of Multicultural Support, and I got the job. I gave up a full-time job to work part-time in that office because I wanted to work with students, and I think I was part-time for more than a year, which meant half of my salary was gone. But it was okay because I was doing something I loved to do. And I was watching young folk who would come into my office defeated and leave as if they had springs in their feet. And you see, that's what you can do for young folk. If you allow them to see their potential. Did I do it to be recognized at this stage in my life with a building being named after me? No. Never in my wildest dream would I ever have imagined that this would happen to me. So, of course, it's affirming. And it's affirming to me because the students voted for me. I loved what I was doing. I'd go back and do it again. Is it something that's going to change me and make me a different person? No, I am who I am. I always said God placed me in that position. He gave me a job to do. I always wanted to do it well. I will say, I am a servant. Now, not like you would consider that word to be defined from a standpoint of African-American who descended of slave. I'm not that kind of servant. I'm a servant of God to do as much for the people as I possibly can. If I see a need and I can fill it, I want to fill that need.
Well, that's Lily Reynolds Parker. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.